Watch Talk Heathen live Sundays at 1 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/YTTH and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callTH.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Truth Wanted. I am your host this week, MD Aware. This is a live call-in show that happens every single week, Fridays at 7 p.m. Central Time, where we talk to people about what they believe and why. If you would like to call us, you can at 1-512-991-9242 or visit tiny.cc/callTW. You see that at the bottom of the screen. Truth Wanted is a product of the Atheist Community of Austin, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to the promotion of atheism, critical thinking, secular humanism, and the separation of religion and government. And I'm glad to be here. I was on the Halloween episode, but I haven't hosted in a while. And I'm equally excited to be here with my guest for this week, Kelly.
Hi, MD. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And Kelly, you are a, what would you call yourself, a mineralogist or a gemologist?
I am a mineralogist/gemologist. I do not have a degree in it. I actually have a degree in English. I went back to college for a year to learn more about geology. So I found out that, I became an English major, so I would have something to fall back on in case I couldn't make it as a short order cook. But both careers fell through, so I ended up going into the retail end of gems and minerals. And I would have people ask me all the time, well, how did something like this form? And I really didn't have the answers for them. So I went back to school and took a bunch of geology classes. Like I said, I didn't get a degree in it, but I went back to learn all the basics of it. And I've been studying it now for 4 years. I've been published. I've had been published in peer-reviewed journals on geology. So I think you might be able to call me a geologist at this point. So
yeah, I mean, that's awesome. And how did you get into mineralogy and geology?
I started out when I was like 5 years old. Basically, I walked down the street and picked a rock up out of everybody's driveway and brought them home, and that was my rock collection. And they were really all the same kind of rock. They were just from each everybody's driveway. Of course, Mom threw it out a couple of days later, but that was basically how I got started. I just liked rocks, and it just kept growing. It was like an addiction, really. It was worse than crack. It's just another kind of rock.
and now you own your own shop, right?
Yes, I do have a brick and mortar shop. And we have a website. My son and I.
Cool. And so how did you transition from this being like a thing that you did as like maybe a hobby? Like, I guess you were a collector first, and then so how did you mm-hmm. transition that into like a business?
Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting question. One day, I decided this was what I wanted to do, and I was actually working in a plastics factory. I was running the shipping dock there, and I was really getting tired of doing that kind of stuff. And I just said, you know, here I am. I have a degree. I'm not a dumb person, and I'm running a shipping dock for somebody else, and I wanted to do something on my own. So I didn't really have the money to start doing it, so I sold everything I had and used it to invest in starting a business. And I actually lived out, my ex-wife and I lived out of an RV for a few years and traveled around the country and worked at a bunch of art shows and festivals and collected rock over the place, made jewelry. That was how I got started.
That's amazing.
So it was kind of like just a favorite stone.
Yeah.
Tourmaline.
Oh, nice. Do you have a sample or can you describe it?
Probably not, but it's a beautiful crystal. It is a gemstone. It comes in almost every color you can imagine, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful stone. So
I'll have to look it up. That's awesome. And I guess the thing that makes me interested is I understand that you're a source for some people interested in crystal healing.
Well, I do have a lot of, we do have a lot of people that come into our store all the time expecting to find healing crystals here. And while the crystals we sell can be used for that, we specifically let people know that we do not believe in that. We even have a couple of signs posted in different places around the store that say our crystals are guaranteed to have no healing power. And if you are healed, if you bring a note back from the doctor, we'll give you your money back. So
that's fantastic. And so do you have any insight into like what it is about crystals that people are drawn to in terms of like healing properties? Like what do people think about, how do people rationalize the ability of a crystal to heal them? Do you have any insight into that? What have you heard from your customers?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things. One of the ways that people will scientifically rationalize it is through quantum physics, right? You can tell that they don't really have a grasp of quantum physics when they're explaining it, but it's one of the things that, well, you know, everything vibrates on a quantum level. And if you take one thing that's vibrating and put it next to another thing vibrating, the vibrations will affect each other. You know, it doesn't quite work that way, but that's the way they rationalize it from a scientific point of view. Mm-hmm. And then I think it gains in popularity because a lot of people who have medical problems that medical community in the USA are not addressing in the right way, because the problems are often not physical, but mental or emotional, right? And so people can't get any help by going to their local general practitioner. So they end up turning to alternative methods to try to heal themselves. And I think that's why it gained in popularity. And when you have a whole bunch of people who are just like you affirming that this is what you need, it goes a long way. It's easy to become indoctrinated into it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think it is about crystals specifically that is alluring? What are people looking for in a healing crystal?
They actually have books that you can look at, books that'll tell you all the types of what those crystals are good for healing. It's honestly crazy. Excuse me. And every time somebody makes a new discovery, they find some way, something that's good for too, you know? So a good example of that is there was a type of fluorescent sodalite that glows in a black light that was found in the state of Michigan on one of the beaches on Lake Superior. And the guy who found it started calling it Uper lights because they call the Upper Peninsula the Uper. And now it's like crazy in the metaphysical market. The guy who discovered it did a bunch of UFO videos. He claims to have seen a bunch of UFOs and everything. Wow. And unfortunately, I wrote the scientific paper that identified the minerals that I kind of helped kick off the whole fad, and I kind of hate myself for it. So,
wow. I'm going to have to look you up later. PubMed or Google Scholar. that's crazy. What an interesting discovery, though. My research, I did some work on fluorescence, obviously not with like minerals, but with, nanoparticle technology. Mm-hmm. And so I was exploiting the fluorescent properties of other organic compounds. And here's like a bunch of people trying to exploit the fluorescent properties of inorganic compounds. Interesting how close they can be. I guess that's what they rely on, right? Is like proximity to truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting.
Interestingly enough, some friends of mine went out looking for uranium minerals near here one night in the middle of the night with UV lights. And they found what they thought was a bunch of them, brought it back, and it turned out to be a fungus. So they were looking for organics and found organics. So
how do you find uranium? Like, you're saying that you can find like uranium containing rocks just around?
Well, not just around. This was a location that was discovered back in the 50s. The uranium rush in the 50s was actually the largest mineral rush in the history of the United States. It was bigger than any of the gold rushes. Hmm. And people were buying old civil defense Geiger counters and just walking around with them turned on all the time, just walking around through the wilderness. And that's what happened here. Guy walking up the Huron River and his Geiger counter started clicking. Wow. And while there's a deposit there, it's not commercially viable. It's really, really small. There's just not enough there for any company to be interested in going out there. So somebody like you or I can go out there and dig some up if we wanted to.
And what do you do with it once you have it?
I sell it. So, but
and it's like safe. Like you can like does it?
A lot of uranium minerals are a lot safer than most people think they are. I have quite a few of them. We sell quite a bit of radioactives, and most of them are just gamma radiation. It's just, or not gamma, alpha radiation. And right. we have them inside of two cardboard boxes, and almost all radiation is stopped at those two boxes. So.
Right, right. That's cool.
You just don't want to lick them.
Yeah, exactly. Can you ship them?
Yeah, believe it or not. Yeah, you wouldn't think, but yeah, you can't.
Wow, that's really interesting.
I actually went on an airplane with one once, but I didn't bring a carry-on to my luggage, and okay. I warned them where it was beforehand. So, but yeah, that's I was neat. Able to carry one on the plane.
And what's like the most popular thing that people come in asking for?
That interestingly, and one of the things is the Uper lights I was just talking about, fluorescent sunlight. Mm. And probably the other two things are very new ages. One is Moldavite. It's a type of tektite from the Czech Republic. And a tektite is glass that was formed when a meteorite hit the earth. Mm. Because of the heat and the pressure of the impact, it turned the soil into glass.
Cool.
And it's a really pretty green color. It's sort of like the old 7-Up bottles, if you're old enough to remember the old 7-Up bottles.
Okay, that's color. Really yeah. cool.
And it's kind of like one, and probably,
go ahead, Kelly.
Oh, I was about to say the other one is a mineral called, it's called shungite, and it's a type of coal from Siberia, and it's like 98% pure carbon. And they have this idea in the metaphysical market right now that if you have a piece of shungite and you put it by your computer, it'll suck up all the EMF waves so it doesn't affect your health.
That's a good one. Wow.
Yeah.
And so what do you do when you encounter these people? Like, they come into your store, and do you try to convince them that there's no healing properties or there's no EMF sucking properties, or how do you approach it?
I will explain that to them, that there just isn't any scientific research that it does anything like that. But I have to walk a thin line because I still want them to spend money. So right. I've learned to use street epistemology a lot. And instead of trying to convince somebody that they're wrong and I'm right, I try to people thinking so that when they're driving back home from my shop, they think, wow, you know what? That's a pretty good point. Maybe there is something to that. And I actually had one woman call me after she got home and asked me some questions. And I thought that was awesome. So, yeah.
That's a huge win. Yeah. I mean,
that was a huge win for me.
And the street epistemology approach is so effective, right? Like, I don't know. I find it like so effective. I use it in my like day-to-day job when I'm trying to, because when you're trying to convince anyone of anything, right? You use a street epistemology approach, and it's very non-confrontational as compared to, you know, some of the other approaches you could be taking.
Right. So it lets them figure it out on their own instead of you having to tell it to them. And let's face it, if you're telling people something, most people will dig their heels in and go the opposite way anyway. So
exactly.
If you can work it out so that they figure it out on their own, it's a much better teaching tool, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. This has been very interesting. I would love to hear from somebody, if there's any watchers or listeners who are into crystal healing. I want to hear what you think. We want to hear from you and talk about it. So give us a call. The number is there at the bottom of the screen again, 512-991-9242 or tiny.cc/calltw. We have some open lines still. You know, Kelly, I think we should get to some calls, but before we do, we need to do a shout out to our patron of the week, because every week we get to shout out a patron who donates through our Patreon, which is tiny.cc/patreontw. This week's patron of the week is Matthew Schultz. I'm going to say it's Schultz. So thank you, Matthew. And as some of you may know, anytime I'm hosting, the patron of the week gets a patron sainthood. So Matthew, I'm giving you the patron sainthood of succulents. So you're the patron saint of succulent. That's those like things like cactus and aloe and things like that. So thank you, Matthew. And thank you to everyone else who contributes to the show. And now, Kelly, I think it's time we should get to a call. What do you think?
All right. Sure. Sounds good.
Fantastic. There's one person who's been on the line for like over an hour now. And so we absolutely have to bring them in. Let's talk to Arthur, them from New York, who wants to talk about the use of pharmacological substances and or mental illnesses in early mankind and their aid in formulating the first religions. Arthur, you are live on Truth Wanted.
Yes, sirs. Thank you for the esteemed pleasure of taking my call and the honor of speaking to you fine gentlemen this evening.
Oh, it's great to have you. So what do you got for us today?
Thank you. You know, I wanted to talk about the subject which you just mentioned, and You know, I've been doing a lot of thinking on it over the many years that I've been dealing with my own cognitive disorders. I don't like the term mental illness. I find that to be kind of a stigmatic kind of term that brings a lot of stigma into the realm of the disorder. But I deal with my own cognitive disorders, such as schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, that sort of thing. I hear voices, see visions, and I have since 2005. And when I was a young child, I heard voices at different times. You know, and one of my doctors told me that even though I was genetically predisposed to become a schizophrenic or schizoaffective, that if I hadn't been experimenting with substances, pharmacological, psychoactive substances, that perhaps I never would have come down and landed myself with schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia. You know, and in early mankind, you know, they had to be coming, Cro-Magnon men and Homo erectus had to be coming into contact with such substances and plants like salvia and ayahuasca roots and all those different sorts of things in early Canada. Cannabis plants and hemp and, you know, sativa, indica, that sort of stuff, you know, and so they're probably, you know, hallucinating, you know, psilocybin mushrooms, and they're probably hallucinating and, you know, hearing voices and hearing grunts and groans, and which ultimately changed the, you know, possibly even changed their brain structure over time. MD Aware and Kelly, I'd like to get your input on that. Do you think it changed these pharmacological substances, changed early mankind's brain structure as to cause us to develop language and that kind of thing, and then cause those, when we develop language, we continue to use those substances, and then when we were hearing voices and seeing these visions, we ascribe names to them, like Odin and Thor and Vishnu and so, Shiva.
Okay. All right. Let's take a step
There's
back.
There's a lot to take in there.
This is a lot. Yeah, it's a lot all at once. Okay. Yeah. So I think the first point that I wanted to hit is the stigma associated with mental illness. I totally agree that there is a stigma associated with it. And that's like obviously a big problem, and one that I think there's a lot of movement from the medical community, at least, to try to solve. The way physicians see mental illness is the same as, like, you know, a physical illness, something that, you know, you need to be able to diagnose and therefore treat according to the diagnosis, right? I totally agree with your physician, even though this is like, I'm not a psychiatrist, but absolutely there is like an interaction between everyone's genetics, which gives them their predispositions, and the environment that they're in, which includes, you know, not only the substances you take, but also, you know, the social situation you live in, what you're eating, what air you're exposed to, you know, like literally everything in your environment. Mm-hmm. Practically everything that's not genetics, you could say, is environmental, right? So there's definitely good studies that say that you could have, you know, if you had a twin, Arthur, who had identical genetics to you. You do. Do you have an identical twin?
Not identical. I have a
fraternal.
What do you call it? Paternal. Yeah, female. Yeah, a girl.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, say you had an identical twin, but I mean, obviously, you're going to be very genetically similar to your twin. But even if you had identical DNA to someone else and they were not exposed, it's very possible that you would have developed these mental illnesses that you're talking about, and they wouldn't have, just because they haven't had that interaction with the environment. So I totally agree with that point. The next thing that I think you were mentioning is that, like, can these substances affect brain structure? Which I think, so they can, but only in the individual using them, or in like the individual exposed to them, right? So because they're not, as far as we know, they don't affect your DNA, which means they can't be passed on to the next generation, right? But obviously, if you're using these drugs, and there's there are studies that have shown not only the effect of a drug on brain structure, but also the effect of a drug on the brain structure of, say, you know, a fetus that's being carried by someone using the drug, and also just having something like schizophrenia fundamentally changes your brain structure, or those changes in brain structure are the cause of the schizophrenia, right? It's hard to know which is which. It's a correlation effect.
Right.
What do you think, Kelly? What are your thoughts so far?
I think you're right. I know as a result of that changing brain structure genetically, I don't think that you could say it would be like the cause for the beginnings of language. I think that had more to do with just they having to be able to share ideas, and probably not so much, like definitely ideas, not so much physical things, because we could have just pointed at stuff, but we had to be able to share abstract ideas. And I think that's probably the real origins of language right there. So
did you come up with this idea, Arthur?
Oh, I've been meditating and I've been thinking about it for years now. And it's just as it relates to my own experiences, pharmacological substances and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, my own personal experiences with mental disorder, my own cognitive disorders. I also suffer from PTSD from childhood trauma, you know, and that can tend to affect my schizoaffective schizophrenia disorders. There's an interplay there, you know, and not necessarily. Now, Kelly, I'd like to address, if you don't mind, what you just said and then be aware about language and the aid of pharmacological substances on language in the brain. Now, Kelly, if you don't mind, could you just repeat really the tail end of what you said about you don't think that it's not necessarily pharmacological substances that affect the language?
No, I think language came about not because of some drugs that they were doing, but because of the need to share abstract ideas.
Oh, okay, right. You don't think that the use of pharmacological substances possibly had any effect at all on the brain structures, in the structures in the brain, specifically the ones that are involved with understanding language?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I am right in line with what MD said earlier about that it can affect the brain. What effect it is having on the brain could very well be individualistic as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And point about maybe your problems that you may have started because of you doing psychoactive drugs. Just speaking from experience, I was on Grateful Dead tour for many, many years, and I saw this happen to a lot of people that seemed like they had a latent emotional or mental condition that was brought out when they took some kind of serious psychoactive. So that doesn't surprise me when the doctor told me that, because I don't know that it's an actual fact, but like I said, in my experience, I've seen it happen quite a few times. Idea about could this be like the beginnings of religion? Yes, totally. It could totally be beginnings of religion. And hearing voices could also contribute to that, to the beginnings of religion. I have no problem believing that.
MD Aware and Kelly, would you like to hear another theory of mine? And I'm sure you guys agree on this, especially Kelly and MD Aware. So obviously, you know, in early societies of mankind, you know, they had the Cro-Magnon men and the Homo erectus, they lived in caves, you know, and eventually we had to leave those caves and start to build huts and houses and that sort of thing. You know, we're just communal people. We don't really like to tend to live alone. And so, like, obviously these experiences, these deep, profound experiences that they would be having on hallucinogenics or cannabis or any such thing like salvia, anything like that, psilocybin mushrooms, of course they're going to be sharing that with the tribe. And of course there's a leader of the tribe, always a leader, that indoctrinates other people, right? The initiator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you sound like you're trying to get us to, like, you're leading us to something. What are you leading us to?
Well, I'm not necessarily leading you to something. I'm just leading you to the idea that they share individuals maybe would go into a hut somewhere, or more one individual or a whole group of individuals do these hallucinogenics, do these pharmaceuticals or pharmacological substances, you know, to commune with these spirits and get these visions and hear these voices that they would see and hear when they were under the influence of these plants and substances. And then they would share them with the tribe, and then the tribe would say, oh yes, you know, this is what this means, you know, like, and, you know, or the wise woman or the wise man would say, this is this voice, or that's this voice, and this is what this means and that means, and that's how ancient a formal religion.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that that's the root, or that can be a potential cause of some, ancient forms of spiritualism or religion or whatever you'd want to call it. I think it's hard to pin down that that actually happened. I think we'll never know, right, what the true like origin of the very first religion was, right? But I think the other thing that you bring up that Kelly and I were talking about earlier, actually, is that there's a lot of misattribution of cause, right, involved there. So like, you know, someone has like a drug trip and there's different ways to interpret that experience that you have. Right. And we're all like, right. I think we're always interpreting our experiences. And then if we have a particularly strong one or a particularly emotional experience, like you might when you're taking some substance, you can interpret that as being, you know, a physical effect that a substance is having on your brain, or you can interpret it as, you know, somehow communing with spirits or a god or whatever, right? And I guess the difference is, do you think that it's that your experience is representing a true thing, or is it representing, you know, a misfiring of your brain, or not even a misfiring, but like an expected and predictable response from your brain, right? And that's probably that misattribution is probably where some of these like spiritual and like religious beliefs come from. I totally agree with you from that perspective. What do you think, Kelly?
Kelly, did you want to chime in?
I think, a lot of people, when they take things like LSD or mushrooms or peyote, they do have what they would describe as a spiritual experience, right? So there is something happening there. And as MD's said, that a lot of people identify the cause of that experience. So if everybody's having that experience when they take the same drug, doesn't that say to us that is what the drug does, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of when you have that spiritual experience, it's the drug. It's not a spiritual experience, right?
But Kelly, can I offer a counter? Because and this is odd. I think one of your call screeners, your call screeners are awesome, by the way, guys. I got to give a shout out to the call screeners because they are epic. But he forgot to ask me if I was a theist. And I don't know if they asked this for Truth Wanted, so they might not. But they didn't ask me if I was a theist or an atheist or what I identify as there. And I teeter totter between both, because mostly I'm an anti-theist because I hate my father. You know what I mean? I really do hate him. I'm an anti-theist. But but I think to give you a counter, Kelly, I forgot where I was going with my counter. No, I can't give it to you. It was such a good counter.
So what do you believe? What do you believe?
What do I believe? I believe.
Yeah, tell us what you believe.
Because I'm extremely liberal with my beliefs. I wouldn't say I'm a Christian. I would say I'm a Taoist, a Buddhist. I have some Christian tendencies. I do believe in Elohim, Jehovah, whatever you want to call him. I think he's at the top of the rung. I believe in Vishnu, Shiva. I accept all the gods as individuals and deities alike. I believe that.
Arthur, it sounds like you sort of believe things that sound good to you, or that I don't want to say make you feel good, but something along those lines, right? Do you approach the religious beliefs from an emotional perspective and an experiential perspective?
I approach them from both, and I also approach them from a romantic perspective. The reason I choose, in the face of the fact that to me there almost is no evidence or proof, even though I have good evidence, I have some good anecdotal evidence that God exists, believe it or not. I got it in black and white. I'll give it to you if you want to hear it after I share this. But one of the reasons I believe is because of romance. I think spiritualism, spirituality, all the faiths and the spiritual books of the world add a little bit of spice. You know, it's like what's you know, you can't have.
So you think the world is more interesting with all these religions, all these beliefs?
Yeah, wouldn't it be a little? I mean, if the last, I mean, when you know, who was it? Alexander the Great or? Was it Alexander the Great, when he killed the last, who he thought was the last Christian, he erected a statue for the last Christian that he thought he killed? because he thought he wanted the monument for the last Christian. And I think that says a lot. That speaks volumes to me. And I think it should speak volumes to everyone who hears that story, because I think that he thought it was a sad thing, and he wanted, that he killed the last Christian. And so he wanted a monument to be built in memorial of that religion. And if the atheists win, if the anti-theists win, like I hope they do, But like I say, I hate my father. I think something, a great sadness would happen. Something. Go ahead.
What are we trying to win? I was just wondering what we're trying to win.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, Kelly. I don't mean to put you in the sense of like in all the, I mean, some atheists are anti-theists, and you might not be an anti-theist. And I don't mean to put you in that category, but I mean,
but even still, what is an anti-theist trying to win?
I think they're trying to basically, just get rid of organized religion altogether. And this, and they want rationality. Since anti-theists and atheists alike see religion and faith as irrationality, I think they would ultimately like to see everyone come to this enlightening moment where they can leave their faith behind and say, especially like Dave Warnock dying out loud, you know, like I have a lot of respect for Dave, but like I can't wait to talk to him, and I haven't gotten the chance yet because I have so much sadness when he says that, like, he's never ever he says it all the time, and he says Christians devalue this life because they believe they're holding on to hope for another life, and that devalues this one. But my faith, my spirituality and my faith, the faith I've come to believe in, because I do hear voices and see visions, and they trust me, they are amazing, and the things they say to me, quite epic and amazing. And this world, I appreciate it all the more because I believe in another world.
It's a very interesting perspective. And you know what, Arthur, we've really enjoyed talking to you. So I want to say thank you for calling. We're going to have to cut it off there because we've got a couple of other calls to get to, but you know, it's a very interesting point. And I think that what Arthur was talking about, that romance, he seems to be basing a lot of his beliefs on this romantic idea of, you know, religion is just like a spice that people sprinkle into their lives, and it provides a little bit of an extra something special. I think that view probably leaves out a lot of the harms that religion does, both directly and indirectly. I don't know. What do you think, Kelly?
I wanted to get this point across. I think if you're trying to compete with something that's irrational, you're going to lose all the time.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't try to win anything with my religion. Do I try to get my ideas across to other people? Yeah, but I don't feel like I have to be in competition.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I certainly don't like being branded as I don't like the spin of us being like soldiers, you know? There was like
exactly
at the beginning of the new atheist movement, there was this whole thing of like, you know, the atheist army sort of thing. And I really dislike that branding. But anyway, we're going to get some more calls. But first, as you may know, the ACA hosts several other shows other than Truth Wanted, including The Nonprofits, which Kelly frequents, Secular Sexuality, Talk Heathen, and The Atheist Experience. If you didn't catch all of the shows last week, here's a taste of the things you might want to go back and check out.
It doesn't have to go super fast. It doesn't have to go super slow. It can go whatever pace that you want it to be, because you don't have to care about another person in the room. It's one of the best parts about masturbation is nobody else is there.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want.
I feel like I'm going to put this on and I want to learn about QAnon. And why do I have this? I don't know. But teach me.
John just put on a cloud nose inexplicably. I think that's QAnon is what I'm going to call that.
QAnon!
QAnon.
You don't have freedom from religion. Well, that's right. I don't have freedom from religion. But I still have the right to tell you to off if you're trying to impose it on me, and off if you're trying to impose it on my children. I still have that right.
This water has magic powers now. Does that mean that this water has magic powers just because I said it? Or do we need some other way of verification?
Yeah, well, you need to be a reliable source.
I'm a super reliable source.
Trustworthy.
I'm incredibly trustworthy.
The oceans and all of the rivers on Earth are supposed to turn into blood. Did we miss that? It has happened. It is happening in China. It's happening in India.
The ocean is turning to blood in China and India? What are you talking about?
Welcome back. To follow up on that, if you can arrange to be in the Austin area between November 17th and 20th, consider joining us in the studio audience at the ACA Free Thought Library for a live broadcast of Secular Sexuality. That's going to be with Christy and JP Cardenas, Truth Wanted with Dan and Jamie Boone, Talk Heathen with Dan and Forrest Valkai, and the Atheist Experience with Forrest Valkai and Kripal. It's like a circle of hosts. Doors open at 6 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and noon on Sunday. Parking is air quotes where you can find a legal spot after the lot is full. If you can't make it there this month, we will continue to broadcast live from the library the last week of each month. So keep watching this show and on the website atheist-community.org for news and information as we expand our in-studio offerings in the near future. With that out of the way, Kelly, do you want to jump into another call?
Sure, I'd love to.
All right, let's talk to Kevin. Kevin, he, him, is calling from Tennessee about occultism.
What is up, Kevin, Kelly? How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Kevin?
We were just talking in Discord. I wanted to jump in and say a few things.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, what we were talking about with to do the topic about occultism and it's having a sort of a grounded perspective on it.
Yeah, go for it. I feel like I'm third wheeling this conversation that you've already started with Kelly, but bring me up to speed.
So sorry. Yeah, we were in Discord and we were just having a great conversation. For one thing, holy crap, to the guy that was just there, he basically just was like copy and pasted exactly what I just was just going over in our conversation about evolution and psychedelics role and and potential role in doing that. So that was a mind messing with me at the with that as well as I have issues with psychosis.
I was kind of having deja vu there too.
Talk about coincidences or synchronicities, if we will.
Yes, right. Talk about yes.
Yeah, that's.
So, what do you want to talk to us about today?
Okay, so let's go with that. Occultism, and sort of because I have gone through. Because when I got out of my religion, I went through the whole New Age stick and things, and I jumped in to every rabbit hole that I could go through. But on the other side, I then started to listen to atheists and skeptics and things and debunking New Age stuff. And really, I came out of it with a little bit more of a balanced perspective on this, because I'm not completely crazy New Age, but I'm also I'm logical, in the sense that I value what skeptics have to say. So I've really reinterpreted the things as the ideas that are propounded by the New Age. I've gotten rid of quantum because I'll be the first to tell you I have no idea what the hell quantum has to do with any of it. It can be explained through the mind and the potential collective unconscious as proposed by Jung.
I'm just gonna leave Jung aside for a second. Can you tell us you want to talk about occultism? Yes, is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
So can you define what we're talking about then? Like, what do you mean by occultism?
Occultism would be the study of the esoteric, magic, and it's the philosophy behind that and how it is supposed to work, as well as the study of the way in which we communicate with our unconscious to do magic. That would probably be the the technical definition of what I would say occultism is, or at least the Western esoteric tradition that I've been studying.
Okay, now I'm interested. So do you believe in this magic?
I do believe in magic. Yes.
Okay. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Right. So yes. So magic is Aleister Crowley's idea of magic is making change in accordance with will. So we do this, in that broadest sense of the term, we do magic unconsciously all the time. It's just that the magician is conscious of it, and that he ultimately takes the role as the central central agent in his own life, and he works with his own subconscious in order to bring about changes within his own consciousness, as well as what he brings to the table to in the sense of his skills and ability to manifest what he or they in the world. So that would be that.
Are we talking about anything more than just like taking physical actions and thereby influencing your environment or the world around you?
That is one application of magic. The other application would be to work within the collective unconscious. And
what is the collective unconscious?
So the collective unconscious is pretty much that we have a personal subconscious that is ours, and uniquely ours. It's our own mind, but our minds are connected to, I hypothesize. I'm not saying that this is what
I
is.
Get it. This is your conception of the thing.
Right. So the collective unconscious is all of our minds connected with our species. Excuse me, our species.
How are those minds connected?
The other creatures. I don't know. That's the most
okay. Let me put it a different way then.
I can describe.
How do you why do you think these minds are connected?
Is this based on Jung's idea of the collective consciousness?
As the what?
Jung had the idea of the collective consciousness, right? And that's why we have icons of memory like dragons and unicorns, because they were all part of this ancient collective consciousness. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, that where our experiences, especially the last caller when he was talking about entheogens and the and what we were. What we were doing, in our ancient cultures and shamanic, settings, is that we were, we're especially through our dreams and all these things, that we are drawing from a well of these archetypal images and things that are issuing forth from what I would call some people call it the Tao, some people call it Brahman, but that would be, sort of what, this is issuing off from. If we, in a hermetic perspective or Kabbalistic perspective, from the Ein Sof.
So how do you know that we're not, why do you think that we're, in your metaphor, drawing from a common well rather than everyone is just drawing on their own individual experiences, and it's just that our experiences are not all that different? There's like a sort of, all humans have roughly the same experience. We encounter roughly the same types of things in our lives and respond in roughly similar fashions. Like, why do you think that there is something more than just each person is not all that different from the person next to them, and we sort of all respond to the same things in similar ways?
I would say that
because what I would say is that what you could see, for example, you could see unicorns, for instance, in a whole bunch of cultures. You ask people to draw a mythical creature and maybe some of them draw a unicorn. But then say you go to like a isolated island where people have never interacted with any other culture, and they have never seen anything that even looks like a horse. They've never even seen anything that walks on four legs. They've only ever interacted with like birds and fish and then like other humans. Those people, I suspect, would not have this notion of a unicorn. That would not exist for them because they have no experience of it. But they'll have, within their society, they'll have common conceptions of other things, right? And I think that if you look back, you'll find examples of this. I'm just not a social scientist, so I can't pick out a specific example. But that's what I would propose, is like the reason people are drawing similar, you know, conclusions about things in, so, you know, apparently independently, is that they're facing like similar issues, right? And they're sort of responding in similar ways. And it's not that there's a common well that we're all drawing from, it's that there's a common mechanism we're all using, and that mechanism is our human brain, and that's our interpretation engine. What do you think of that?
I haven't thought about it that way, really. That is something I'll have to contemplate on, and possibly discard some of the beliefs that might be loosely held.
I mean,
however,
what do you think, Kelly? I want to hear what Kelly thinks.
I think they're right on there, you know. And I kind of covered this earlier in Discord. I don't know that there is any collective consciousness for us to be drawing off of. I don't agree with the idea at all. I'm really right along in line with MD, where I think we all have experiences, and many of our experiences are very similar, right? I don't see anything special about coincidences. Right. I think a coincidence is just that. It's just a coincidence. We read things into those coincidences. So I think in a lot of ways, the experiences that you're interpreting as being a certain way is just your interpretation and nothing else.
So Kevin, do you have an example of like,
do you have an example of something
that happened? Like, for instance, this, magic you're proposing that acts upon this collective unconscious. Do you have an example of something like that happening where you, induce an idea into someone who has definitely never been exposed to that idea before? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, there is. There are. I listen to a lot of occultists that are, especially one Frater Xavier, that he talks about many. So he talks about coincidences in the sense that when someone does a particular ritual for something. That intention goes, into this hypothesized collective unconscious, that it then introduces, things that or ideas within other people's personal, this is the idea anyways, that these ideas of their will goes into another person's, or the collective, and it changes the way in which, or it changes the, or raises the chance that these things will happen. He says that it's not a guarantee, or you're not exactly going to get exactly what you want. Sometimes you can, but in other time, because he was talking about such as like money magic and something, or manifesting some orange ball or something to come into your life.
Is this like the secret? This sounds like the secret. No.
It sounds like thelemic.
It sounds like
thelemic magic.
What's thelemic magic?
Can I explain? Can I explain the difference? Okay. Yeah,
sure. Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
Okay. So the difference between the secret is the secret proposes that what you believe will, or if you think happy and you think positive, then positive things are going to happen to you, and that is not what we're that's not what we're proposing, because it's the secret is a dirty word actually in the occultist community, or the occult community, because they it doesn't go far enough. There's not any sort of intense visualization that goes with it, or emotion, or any other things besides just thinking about something. That is a part of it, but it's very watered down occultism for the mass, I would say.
Interesting. Okay.
With thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. It's what you're talking about sounds very much like thelemic magic to me. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yes. Golden Dawn. That's where I.
Right.
That's some of the things.
Yeah.
that I've done.
Can you enlighten us here, Kelly? What's Thelemic magic?
It's a system of magic that was developed by the infamous Aleister Crowley some 100 years or so ago, and he thought that you can bend reality through will, basically. If you do these rituals, it increases the power of your will to make the changes in the world. To put it simply.
I'm still confused about the proposed mechanism. I don't want to rehash this, but I feel like the mechanism relies on this collective unconscious that's connected between everyone, but I'm not convinced that thing exists. Do you have any, can you share any reason why I should believe that exists?
You know, the examples that I have, because we're like I was explaining earlier, the world in which the magician works in is subjective. And it is not as objective as the world in which, you know, modern science works. And it is not repeatable in the same way that, you know, a scientific experiment works. It works. In this sense, because, you know, there are, well, that also kind of goes into to statistics and what people do the ritual and what works and what not. I understand y'all's perspective on it. I'm just saying that to the people that do these rituals that say that they do it, they get certain tangible results. It might not always be exactly what they're looking for, but sometimes that it is. And I can't give any concrete repeatable.
This sounds like bad prediction.
Doesn't prayer do the exact same thing?
Yeah, or like Nostradamus did the same thing, right? It's like these people are making predictions about what's going to happen when they cast a spell or perform a ritual or something like that. And then not the thing that they asked for doesn't necessarily happen, but something happens and they claim it as a win, as like a victory or a hit or a result of what they do. How do they know that it actually resulted from what they did, right? It's like I could throw a rock like this behind my head without looking, and then I could turn around and I could see someone dead on the ground. Maybe the rock hit them in the head and killed them, or maybe it had nothing to do with it, right? Like, how do you actually know that what you're doing, the ritual or the spell or whatever, is causing the effect that you're claiming, especially if it's not doing the thing that you say it's going to do, right?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't do it in the way that you expect it would. See, the thing is that these, the proponents of this say that, for one thing, if you keep this spell in mind, so a part of magic is forgetting about it. Once you've done it, you try your hardest to forget about it, because there's something called a lust for results. And if you continue
this
to
seems
to,
like the perfect
make it in your mind,
the perfect setup to have a confirmation bias, because you forget all the spells that you cast, you forget that you never get any results from them, and then something happens and you suddenly go, oh, I cast a spell for that, and then you claim it as a result of your thing. Like, do you know, like, okay,
well,
Kevin, let me ask you.
Yeah.
I get it.
It sounds irrational, and I'm not. And this is actually one thing that I'm not actually fully bought in myself to. You know, I see people, you know, that do that, but I do have my own, you know, thing. My thing more is practical magic that you can do within your own personal personal consciousness. And that has real effects to, you know, to a person.
I'm not doubting the realness of the effect. I'm doubting the cause of those effects, right? And like I'm pointing out these things, which are, as I'm sure you know, these are like cognitive biases and logical fallacies,
right?
And things like this. And my question is not necessarily how do you personally respond to these specific questions. My question is, given that all of these issues exist, how does anyone come to the conclusion that they can believe any of this, right? Like, if I was approaching this just based on, and I know you've only given me, you know, like 20 minutes crash course on this, but like, it seems like what you're saying could potentially be correct, I guess, but like the the hypothesis is so vague and slippery that there's no way you could ever pin it down enough to like actually have any good reason to believe it.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't fit any
type. I have to say that it's incredibly subjective. You know, with what we're doing, and the but you were talking about, you know, how confirmation is seen usually, you know, after a person does, and I'm talking about a completely healthy, you know, mentally, you know, person that engages in magic and does it for a certain time, because say the neophyte grade of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you have to do these spells over and over and over again for at least 6 months before the subconscious understands what's going on in your and it creates the links. So in a part
how do you
of
know
I'm
that
getting to
how
this,
do they know that how do they know this like what like
a part
this yeah, this I'm, is what bothers me so much, right? It's like people are proposing this like collective unconscious to exist in the first place, which they haven't proven. And then they're making all these claims about like, oh, you have to do the spell for at least 6 months before it makes a connection. Like, what do you mean? Like, why does it take that long? Why 6 months? Why does it take more times? Like, there's all these like random rules. Like, it's I don't see any reason to believe this. And you're just throwing these rules at us, Kevin, like, and not providing any basis.
I can say that. So let me give you, you know, something in my own, in my own life.
Hang on. Let Kelly say something.
Can I say something real quick, Kevin? The stuff that you're talking about here, I actually believed in longer than I was a Christian, right? So I got an idea of where you're coming from. I understand the beliefs you're coming from. And I think if you start to look at it from outside yourself and look back in a critical way, and if you start to use some real experiments about the results of what you're doing, I think you're going to find that it has no more of a basis in reality than Christianity does.
I'm open to that.
I encourage some scientific experimentation.
Anyway, Kevin, we really appreciate your call. I'm gonna hang up right now with you just because we've got one more call I want to get to for sure. But I mean, this was a really good conversation and obviously very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to have you call back in, Kevin, on a future show to try to hash this out more. This is the first time I've actually encountered this this like magic belief, Kelly. I've encountered the secret, and it sort of reminds me of the secret in that it's like a will bending reality sort of thing. But other than that, I haven't encountered it before.
And I want to put the invitation out there to Kevin too to continue this conversation on Discord. I really enjoyed it. If you don't mind, MD, there was at least one question that I wanted to answer that came from the YouTube chat, and it was, what does the occult mean outside of Hollywood type definitions? It means the same thing. It just basically is a belief in magic or magical thing, and that's all. That's the actual definition of occult. So.
Gotcha. And let's just get through some of these. We had some other questions from YouTube. Street epistemology. You mentioned that, Kelly. Do you want to give us a 30-second crash course on street epistemology?
It's a way of having a conversation with somebody that's non-confrontational and use questions to further the narrative, if that sounds reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, I think we tried to do some of that here. Obviously, we didn't do a proper street epistemology approach. But if you look up street epistemology on YouTube, there's a bunch of videos. And who is it? Anthony Magnabosco is the guy who does them. And it's all about asking people why they believe something and not doing what I did, which is at some point injecting your own opinion or directly challenging or contradicting someone's opinion or ideas or anything like that, right? Does that sound about right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so just very effective. A little connection to this show. If you look back through Anthony's videos far back enough, you'll find Objectively Dan doing a couple of the videos and see him making his way out of his Christian ideals. So that's a pretty interesting
Objectively
watch.
Dan was like a Christian that was, I don't know, deconverted perhaps by Anthony. It's a cool story.
I don't know that Anthony did it. I think Dan will tell you he was already questioning and Anthony kind of just pushed the ball a little bit further. So, but they're very interesting.
That's how it always is. Okay, let's get through some more announcements, and then there's one more call I definitely want to take. If you'd like to support the show, You can do that by donating to our Patreon, as we mentioned. There's a couple of different tiers there. You can donate at tiny.cc/patreontw. A couple of different tiers. You can get your name shouted out on the show if you donate. You can also support the show by becoming a member. You get emojis in the chat. Your name gets highlighted in the chat, and you become immune to chat timeouts, all for as little as 99 cents per month. Hey, I'm in there. Oh, that's awesome. I only realized recently that I was one of these emojis. If you shop on Amazon, you can support the ACA at no cost to you. Just visit tiny.cc/AmazonSmileACA and designate the Atheist Community of Austin as your selected charity. And Amazon will donate a portion of their profit directly to the ACA. In addition, we have a brand new store, so you can visit tiny.cc/merchaca to get your favorite items like t-shirts, hoodies, coffee mugs, and brand new items like beanies, cell phone cases, and tote bags. And now we're even featuring a special limited edition item each month. This month, it's the it's that Rob Boss photo or painting that Dan painted on the Halloween special. That was a great, great time. So be sure to check that out on our store and all the stores for the other shows as well. Finally, you can listen to the audio-only channel we have as well. Go to tiny.cc/AENpodcast for your one-stop shop for all of our shows in audio form. You'll find Truth Wanted there as well as all of our other shows. And with that, let's get to talk to Susie. Susie, her is calling from Florida, and she wants to talk about Feng Shui. Susie, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes. Back in the late 90s, I did my master's thesis in educational leadership on feng shui, and not many people were very familiar with it back then, and it's more commonly known now. But I found the principles of feng shui applied in my elementary classroom to be really effective, and I'm not sure how much y'all know about the feng shui.
Why don't you give us a crash course, sort of 30 seconds, 1 minute thing for us the audience?
All right. It's based on room arrangement and colors in the room and lighting to help change the to change the energy and feel of a room. And I found the methods, doing all the research I had to do for my thesis, I found them very effective for just creating a calmer environment that that myself and my students benefited from.
Okay.
Did that help?
So Feng Shui is your... defining it as basically arranging what objects in a room?
Furniture placement, the line of eyesight, the way the desks are set up, the way mm-hmm. the lighting is done, colors mm-hmm. used in the room, just like, it's been known for a long time in psychology that colors can have an effect on people's moods, like fast food sure. restaurants. Restaurants all use red, orange, and yellow that stimulate appetite. And then the sure. cooler colors tend to be more calming, those are some of the factors that play into feng shui.
So you say you've noticed an effect in your career in education, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
What do you attribute that to?
Colors and room arrangement so that you create mm-hmm. a good flow pattern, a traffic pattern for walking, and even in the home, feng shui principles applied in the home. Like if you have a home office, it's best not to set your computer desk up where your back is to the door. Same as the principle
why do you,
in your bedroom.
You why want, do you think that is,
you
for example?
To be facing the door. Because if your back is to the door of your office or to the side of your side of vision in your bedroom, it can make you more easily startled when someone walks in.
So do you think it has anything to do with the flow of energy?
That's a toughie because, you know, it talks about, you know, your chi, your energy you put out.
Right.
And it's like, just like when I can kind of walk into a room and you can just kind of feel if people, you walk into a room and you can kind of feel the tension in the room, or if it's a good setting, or if the furniture mm-hmm. arrangement is made where you're walking in the door and then you have to stop and go around a piece of furniture, whereas if you just move it a little bit, you have a better traffic flow. Those kind of principles.
Kelly, what do you think?
Susie, I have to ask you a question, because when you were describing energy, right, and an energy flow, and then you talked about moving furniture, and it seemed like it had nothing to do with any type of energy flow. It just was moving something out of the way, so it made it easier for people to walk through the room. And I'm wondering, when you use the word energy, what exactly are you describing? Like, if you look at the definition of energy, it's the capacity to do work. So if this energy is doing work, if anything is doing work, we can measure the amount of work that's being done. So what work is this energy doing, and how can we measure that work?
I guess I should have, and it sounds like woo, and I'm an atheist, I don't believe in magic, but it's more vibes you get, you know, even if you go into like a new restaurant and it just doesn't, the decor or something just doesn't feel right. And
so are you talking about your personal feelings to the environment?
Yes, but
do you think that I would have the same feelings about that environment?
Yes, because I used to have a lot of parents and administrators that would walk into my room and they would go, "It's so peaceful in here." And I felt like that was kind of reaffirming my method of using color and arrangement of the desk and where my desk was and your back not to the door.
Do you think it's possible, Susie, that perhaps those people were responding not to the room, but to you feeling comfortable in the room that you set up in a way that was comfortable to you? And they get, you know, like as we were discussing earlier on the show, humans are social creatures. We pick up on a lot of social cues subconsciously or unconsciously. And so like, I totally get what you mean about like the vibe of a place, or you can feel the tension in a room. I think that feeling that we get is all our subconscious picking up on cues that we're not consciously aware of. But if you were to study them in a scientific fashion, you would be able to identify, you know, physical characteristics, you know, like someone is holding their body in a very tense fashion, you know, they have their arms crossed or something, and it's, you don't necessarily pick out that specific thing, but you get a vague sense that there's tension in the room. I think that that's perhaps what you're picking up on. What do you think about that?
Yes, certainly, but even if you go to like a party at someone's home, and if a lot of it's used in interior design methods, you know, you set up a conversational area with your couch and your chairs and your floor rug, you know, designating that as an area, and if it's like if things are too far apart and people feel like that kind of like lessens a connection. So I guess
what I'm trying to say, Susie, is that I don't have a problem per se with like the idea that the built environment can affect how people interact with each other in that environment, or how people feel in that environment. I think they obviously, your environment contributes to that. I just don't think it has anything to do with the flow of energy. Do you think that it has something to do with the flow of some form of energy, or is it just like some of the stuff you're describing is like Kelly said, you know, it's kind of obviously better to not have like a table obstructing, you know, a walkway. And that has nothing to do with the flow of energy. It has to do with, like you were saying, Susie, the flow of like human traffic walking through a room. So do you think there's anything like supernatural or like special or something like that? Or is it all just physical stuff?
No, I don't believe in the supernatural. So I do think it's just arranging an environment with colors and furniture placement that can either kind of be jarring and harsh versus calming and welcoming. And that's what a lot of principles are.
I think what you're like, I've studied feng shui. It was actually kind of popular back in the 90s. It's really died off a lot since then. There's reasons, I believe I'll get into those in a second. But I think what you're describing to me doesn't sound like traditional feng shui. It sounds like a newer age interpretation of these older ideas. So I'm not sure that feng shui is the proper way to talk about your colors and moving furniture out of the way, right? Feng shui has more to do with the flow, like putting up mirrors so that the energy flows through the house more readily, right? It can bounce around the mirrors, right? There's a lot of wood chimes that are used feng shui because they're good for producing energy, right? So I'm not sure that this is actual, you know, like real feng shui, because that does rely on this unseen energy force that permeates through the household or the business area. So I'm not sure that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
And I know that they've done studies on colors, and colors will definitely affect your mood. I know that. But environmental psychologists have also done studies on feng shui, and they found that it did nothing. So I'm...
And you mean the traditional feng shui,
you're confusing
color, right?
some psychological phenomena as feng shui that might not be feng shui, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and feng shui can get very deep and very heavy as far as, you know, your house facing, the front of your house should face this direction, and you know, you can really go deep into it, but my college professor had never heard of feng shui, and so he was thrilled with my thesis I did on it. But I had done research. This was early in the computer times, because with my bachelor's, I was using a card catalog at the library. That's how old I am. But just some of the principles of it, and maybe I've cherry-picked it like people cherry-pick the Bible, but many of the principles, I think, are very effective, like you said, with color psychology, and I've applied it in my home. But, you know, I don't believe that, you know, if you leave the toilet seat up, money's going to rush down the drain and you won't make money, you know. You know, those...
I mean...
You can't see the back door from the front door for the same reason money flows through the house. That's actually a feng shui thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Susie, I don't think we have any real disagreements between us. You know, I think it's just that what you're describing, I would call... you know, interior design principles, good user experience design principles, things like this, and even like sort of common sense. And like Kelly said, this is a field of study, right? Like interior design, but also environmental psychology. These are designed spaces. I think probably agree with Kelly that calling it feng shui is maybe misrepresenting or adding on baggage that you don't necessarily want. I don't know. What do you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I think you're correct. And I think to me, that idea of like adding feng shui into it is turning it into some magical, mystical thing. And a lot of what, like I said, what you described seem to me to be known scientific, psychological principles that we fully understand. There's nothing magical or mystical about it at all. Like color psychology.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but hey, interesting call. So thanks, Susie, for the call. As always, we appreciate all these calls. Unfortunately, we're essentially out of time. But hey, you can keep in touch with us. You can email us if you want to. truth@atheist-community.org. You can reach out to the ACA at tv@atheist-community.org and see what's been going on at our website at atheist-community.org. There's also a Facebook group. It's run by fans and for fans. Go to tiny.cc/fbtwg to interact with other fans. And you can debrief about the shows and talk more about what we talked about on the show. So all of those things are great. You can also reach out to me on Twitter. I am EMDEEAWARE on Twitter. Kelly, are you on the socials?
I am. Excuse me. I'm a moderator on the atheist community of Discord. I have a couple of features over there, including Wednesday evenings called Meet the ACA. You've been my guest there, MD, and I appreciate that. We are also started the shows back up, and you'd like to join us for the after show. I'm going to go over to Discord and have one. MD, you're more than welcome to join us. So
Cool.
I just got a little tongue tied there.
Well, it happens after, like, you know, being on live for an hour and a half. So thank you, Kelly, so much for being on. But last but not least, we have to thank the crew, obviously, our fantastic crew. Can we see the crew cam? Are there any cats on the crew cam today? No cats. Oh, but Greg, he's basically a big
cat. There's three cool cats there. What are you talking about?
That's true. All right, good. Thank you, crew, for making this happen every single week. But that's it for tonight. I'm your host, MD Aware. Thank you again, Kelly, for joining me today. Great discussions. And everyone, keep wanting the truth.
Watch The Nonprofits and join the hosts in the live chat Sundays at 3 p.m. Central between The Atheist Experience and Talk Hidden. Visit tiny.cc/ytnp.